The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this week's episode of The Cult Vault. I have a special episode lined up for you. It is an interview with a Sea-Doo survivor named Michael. If you haven't listened to the Synanon or Sea-Doo episodes that I've released previously, I do recommend going back and having a listen so we can all start this interview at the same place. The interview itself was so engrossing and ended up lasting such a long time that I have split it into two episodes. The second part I have uploaded along with this episode, so you can listen to both, one after another, if you wish. As usual, this episode comes with a trigger warning. It includes themes of verbal, physical, psychological, and sexual abuse of children, as well as murder, suicide, and self-harm. Please listen with discretion. I would also like to add a quick shout out to my GoFundMe supporters this week who are making it possible for me to continue podcasting now my maternity leave is over. And those wonderful, amazing people are Connor, Louisa and Brad. Louisa actually gave me the idea to cover cults on my podcast, so an extra special thank you to you. Also, another side note before we jump into it. Michael and I are in different time zones, so this interview took place in the nighttime here in England. There may be periods where you can hear my little baby boy crying in the background because he is currently teething. But don't worry, he wasn't alone. My partner was with him. He's decided to get all of his teeth at once, so for any fellow parents out there, I'm sure you can relate. So without further ado, let's get into it. So thank you so much for agreeing to chat with me. I've been so excited for this for so long.
Well, good. I know you've been doing some pretty intensive research, so I'm sure the story is very prominent in your mind. The more you learn, the more you're kind of like, what?
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely one of those that I think the more you research, the more rabbit holes you will find yourself lost in.
Well, it's my pleasure. I do appreciate you tackling this giant rabbit hole of a subject.
Okay, then. Shall we get started?
Of course, of course.
So, Michael, would you like to introduce yourself to the listeners and give a little bit of a background about yourself?
All right. Gladly. My name's Michael Balaban. I presently live in Las Vegas, Nevada. I'm originally from Chicago, Illinois. I was living in Chicago, and I was originally sent to Sea-Doo, so I guess I was a Chicago kid back then. More recently, I retired a sergeant from the United States Army back in 2015 after injuries incurred in Afghanistan. Before that, I was in retail and furniture management in the family business. And then back in 1993 to 94, from November 15th, 93 to November 15th, 94, when I was 16 and 17 years old, I was a resident at the Sea-Doo School in Running Springs, California.
Okay, and what is Sea-Doo and where did it come from?
Well, I think you did a bang-up job in your last episode, really getting into the origin stories of Sea-Doo. And just to kind of reiterate what you said, Sea-Doo stands for Charles E. Diederich University, as it's understood now. For years and years while it was in operation, it was understood as an anagram for see yourself as you are and do something about it. Or as you want to be, one or the other. It was, as has been found out more recently, a clone of Synanon 1, as we'll call it, the original Synanon from 1958 through 66, 67. You delved very well into the Mel Wasserman background, Bill Lane, and many of the other Synanon members who split off when Charles Dietrich decided to make Synanon a non-graduating program.
Yeah.
And that was when they decided to basically invent their own program with the same backstory focused towards adolescents by the name of CDU. So yeah, it was a residential program under the guise of a school that was originated by the first incarnation of Synanon and the dissatisfaction and disillusionment of original Synanon members at the evolutions that Charles Dietrich put into Synanon.
Okay, and how did CDU specifically differ from Synanon?
Well, the big differences between CDU and Synanon were the fact that Synanon was full of volunteers. There were some Synanon members that were sent there by the courts, whether they be at later on adolescents or earlier, some adults were sent there. At the same time, everyone at Synanon was pretty much there voluntarily looking for some sort of solution to their own addictions or their own paradigms that didn't fit with their lives, in the case of Squares. CDU was instead an institution that was formed for adolescents and children, and none of the attendees at CDU were there voluntarily.
Okay, so how would these adolescents find themselves in a place like CDU?
Well, there were multiple methods. I mean, it really comes down to not only what were the causes, but the people that were involved in sending kids there.
Okay.
The kids there have anything from sexual deviancy issues to drug use, legal issues, absentee parenting in many cases, that were very sold on the growth curriculum while they were off doing their own thing. The truth of it is that the main placements at CDU came from there are three major ways you would end up there. One would be the court systems, where a judge would take an adolescent whose parents had means and require them to sign up for a program, CDU or one like it. This was the 90s in my experience, so there were quite a few that were like it.
Okay.
The others were psychiatrists. A lot of folks that have spoken about CDU before and that I knew were sent there by their doctors. Kids with issues such as cutting, depression, or diagnoses were sent there due to the fact that they accepted kids like that and swore that they could help them. The third major reason that kids got sent there were educational consultants, like you've touched on with Lon Woodbury, who was once an admissions director of CDU and then became an educational consultant.
Okay.
Educational consultants in the 90s and 2000s here in the United States were usually primarily used for colleges and universities. When a kid was graduating high school, their parents would take them to the educational consultant, and they would have a breakdown of all the universities that dealt with their type of goals and aims and majors and such. But those educational consultants also worked with high school kids and their parents to help those parents find the appropriate troubled teen institution to send their kids to. So I would say about 50% of the kids there, in my estimation, were there from educational consultants. The other half mixed between judges and psychiatrists, psychologists.
Okay, and which one of those three were you involved in, so where you found yourself at CDU?
Well, myself, I was I fit fully into the troubled teen paradigm. I had problems with marijuana use consistently when I was a teenager. I was kicked out of a few schools, and then I got in trouble with the law. So it was originally a judge who told my parents they had to send me to an institution such as CDU. And then with the help of an educational consultant outside of Chicago, they found CDU itself. So it was a combination of two factors for me.
Okay. And what was the judge's, why did you appear in front of a judge in the first place?
Well, my story, as it's laid out in the screenplay I've written about it, is that I had quite a few instances. The truth of my situation, I got arrested at a Grateful Dead concert in the summer of 1992. I was sent to a local reform school in Chicago for about 6 months or so, or more like 3 months, from the start of the school year in 93 up until November, when I was kicked out of that school. At that point, I was in arrears of the judge's order, and my parents went to the educational consultant to find a troubled teen institution that was right. More rigorous, that I would be forced to complete my term.
Okay. I've actually read your screenplay, which I was really, really impressed with. It was very insightful, and some parts of it were uncomfortable to read. So if that's how I felt reading your script, I can't imagine how it must feel personally experiencing and living these experiences. But do you think that it's only the first scene, which is sort of your first day. You depicted your first day of arriving on the CEDU campus. Do you think that this experience of yours is personal to you, or do you think it's sort of unanimous to everyone that experiences CEDU?
I can only speak to the CEDU of the 90s when they were in their heyday.
Okay.
But as I research it more, I find more and more students that give testimonial that is very much in line with mine.
Okay.
So I'm starting to realize they had a specific set of methods that they used on any student's first day.
Okay.
That really was sort of a uniform policy. In my screenplay, I go into it, but it really goes into a process of day one. You were either brought there by the escort services, which I'm sure we'll talk about a bit
as
we go on, or you were brought by your parents. The primary method, if you weren't brought by an escort service to the school, to the property from your home, was that your parents would give you a maskirovka, as they say in Russian.
Okay.
The school would tell your parents, don't let your kids know that you're leaving them here. Just tell them you're coming for a tour, you're going to check the place out, and then make your decisions. Don't make any commitments about your children staying long term. But once you got there, as you were touring or in processing, your parents would sign the paperwork and then be off without you. There was this component where they insisted that you be abandoned at the property. After that, you would go straight into a strip search, and then they had this policy where they would set you up so that you would break some small infraction within your first hours there. You would always in process on a Monday, Wednesday, or Friday morning, early afternoon, directly before a wrap started that afternoon. Once you went through that wrap and you were completely torn apart, you would be pushed into a smush session directly after. By the end of your first day, you didn't know up from down, and it was set up that way intentionally.
Okay. And obviously you at this time, you're 16, 17 years old. What is the youngest age for somebody to enroll in this specific program that you were in at CEDU?
Well, they had the CEDU High School, and at the time I was there, they also had a middle school.
Okay.
You touched on the different schools. It originally started with a high school format. Eventually, I believe in the late 80s, early 90s, they brought in the middle school. You would be assigned to one or the other based upon your age at entry. If you were, say, 12 through 14-ish, you would go to the middle school. If you were 14 to 15 on through 18 through 16-ish, which was the latest they would bring you in, you would go to the high school.
Right.
Students that were 16 or 17 weren't brought to CEDU because they would turn 18 during their time there.
Right.
16 was the latest going on 17, so that you'd be there a year or two before you turned 18 and more likely to stay and finish out the program.
Right. And do you believe that this same approach with parents sort of almost abandoning their children was happening to the younger children as well, the 12-year-olds?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's absolutely heartbreaking. I can't imagine a 12-year-old. I can't imagine anybody going through that experience, that whole day in itself, especially being 12 years old. I read the memoir by Zach Bonney called Dead Insane or In Jail, and his depiction of his first day was actually his dad just driving off down the driveway and leaving him there at Sea-Doo after he thought that he was going skiing down the mountainside. And then obviously that didn't happen. He then talks about his cavity search that he endured. So it does seem to sort of have a very tight regime that happens to new people. And we've talked a bit about Whiteout as well, which is Lathrop Liebrook's memoir, and she actually talks about having a cavity search herself as well. Yes. What were your first impressions of Sea-Doo?
Well, I was a little too confused at the time. I was one of the folks that on my initial arrival, I was driven up by my father under the auspices of taking a campus tour just to see the place and see if I wanted to go. Within my first 30 minutes, I was briefly toured around campus to get this first impression of the grandeur of it. The property, as you stated in your last episode, was the old Walter Houston Mansion in Roaning Springs, or Lodge. It was a large wood building, just a massive, massive lodge with a view forever down the backside. The entire complex was beautiful. It was immaculately groomed. I didn't know at the time by students on work assignments, but it was just, it looked like a paradise in many ways. You really didn't have an idea of what you were approaching because the promotional materials were all inspirational. They spent three quarters of it on the academic program that didn't actually exist.
Wow.
So parents were sold on it. You went up there talking exactly like Zach Bonney said, or like Leif Rupp said, is that you went up thinking that you were going on a tour of this beautiful place that took you skiing every winter and had these beautiful wilderness expeditions all the time. They had activities and arts and all these other wonderful things that sold not only the parents, but the students originally. It was only on your first day when you get your first impression, you start out with the grandeur of the place on your basic tour.
Right.
Then while your parents were signing the paperwork, your parents would abandon you there. They'd be told to leave without saying goodbye. That was it. They weren't allowed to say goodbye to you. It was a part of the impact of arrival. So while you're touring this magnificent campus that, in all truth, you barely get to use any of the amenities while you're there, you end up abandoned. And then while you're dealing with that abandonment, you're being pulled into the admin office for your body cavity search.
And by that point, your parents have left.
They're gone, and you're on your own in this beautiful place about to start experiencing things that'll throw you so far off kilter, you don't know up from down anymore.
Okay, so you've arrived at Sea-Doo. You've had your first day. Obviously, you touched upon, you know, the beautiful scenic mountains that you can see, the impressive building itself that parents are probably really, really impressed with. What is the rest of your Sea-Doo experience? What is the entire structure of what is the curriculum, so to speak?
Well, there's where it's a little difficult because the curriculum differed from student to student based on a couple of factors.
Okay.
The number one factor that determined what your curriculum at Sea-Doo was your agreement status.
Okay.
When I say agreement status, we're using Sea-Doo lingo here. You weren't breaking rules or you didn't break rules or go with rules. You were either in agreement or out of agreement.
Right.
Sea-Doo famously said, we don't have rules here. We have agreements.
Okay.
Whether you actually agree or not, they're agreements. You're either in agreement with it or out of agreement. Those agreements determined how you were treated at the school. The further out of agreement you were, the more consequences you would face, and the more your curriculum and your daily activity would change. The other thing that really changed the way that the day worked was your placement within the program, what stage you were or peer group.
Okay.
When you started out, your daily routine was way different than when you were getting towards the end.
Right. Okay.
You didn't even go to academic classes for your first 6 months there. The academics that you did were called work ethics.
Right.
That was the name of the class. And you'd spend all day at the wood the woodshed, cutting wood, chopping down trees, doing manual labor.
So chores.
And literally they try to give you high school credits for it.
Right, okay.
As you advance, you added more academics, you went through the different workshops and prop beats, got more trust, were able to expand yourself, got a bit more free time. You were allowed to do more with that free time. It really depended on how far along you were and how much you were getting with the program.
Okay.
I think the basic way to say it is you start out, your curriculum was work assignments and wraps. And then as you progress through the different workshops and profits and through the different peer groups and levels, you would add more academics, you would add more free time, you would add more responsibilities, like touring parents of new kids that are coming in, or touring the new kids themselves. You would be given a job as a big brother or big sister, where you would be monitoring other new students with some of your free time. There were other privileges you would get that would open up the process for you.
Okay.
So it really did depend on a couple of factors. There is no set schedule that you can point to besides wraps every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday afternoon.
Okay.
Other than that, the rest of your time evolved based on those two factors.
So when you talk about being in or out of agreement, how would you find yourself out of agreement, and what would be the repercussions of being out of agreement?
Well, the agreements were numerous. Getting into those is a story unto themselves, with lingo and all sorts of things that would probably seem foreign at this point. But the major, major agreements were, even with smushing and things, no sexual contracts. And by that, there wasn't just a no sex rule. If you even talked too much to a person of the opposite sex, or if you were, if you were LGBTQ, then it would be someone of your own sex. They would monitor that.
Okay.
If you spent too much time with them, you talk to them too much, you, even if someone accused you in a rap of having a sexual contract with someone, like you guys were flirting, but you weren't, you were guilty of it. So that was breaking an agreement. Things like songs and music were out of agreement. It was called popping off. If you started quoting lyrics or even said the name of a band that was forbidden, you faced consequences for it. My gosh, any type of behavior that was against the rules, and basically any time the staff felt you weren't doing your work enough the way they wanted you to, they could even invent infractions.
Wow. Okay.
The entire culture was based upon always being in some form of trouble, whether it be from your fellow students, from the staff, or being incapable of following the numerous and often conflicting agreements.
Okay, so, and you think that it was conflicting on purpose?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Because the more out of agreement you were, the more intensive they could get with their methods, with both the attacks and the raps and the punishments and consequences.
Okay.
There were different levels of consequences you could face. I mean, if you had something minor, like you went and accidentally quoted a song lyric and someone accused you of it in a rap,
okay,
you would face something like dishes. Dishes at the end of the day had different levels. One level, if it was a very minor infraction, you'd spend 10 minutes wiping down tables.
Right.
Severe infractions, you'd be on pots and pans for about 3-4 hours, elbow
right
deep. After that, you got into further punishments, the further you got from agreement. There were things like restrictions, movement restrictions. If you say, let's see, who was it there? Adam Egit, in his Joe Rogan interview, spoke about football. He was a huge Giants fan, I guess. And every Sunday they would put a TV in one of the rap rooms and you would get to watch football if you were in agreement.
Right.
If
okay
you were in punishment or restrictions, like Adam Egit said in his interview, he cheered too much for his team during a football game once.
Okay.
They banned him from football, put him on restrictions on Sundays, so he couldn't go into the room where they were playing. After that, they had consequence where if, say, I had been with Adam and we were cheering too much together, not only would we have been put on restriction from football, but from each other. So they had these things called bans, where if you were even further out of agreement, they would put you on bans from, say, the lower classes, the discovery peer group, the initial peer group, all the new kids in class, because they didn't want you to bring your corruptive behavior to them. So you would have to disavow their entire existence. You get on further than that, you would be on a table or a full-time, which was 24/7 work and writing assignments. Any way it went, the further out of agreement you went, the worse the consequences became. If you initiated a power struggle with the system would break you. And it had escalating levels of consequences in order to do that.
Okay. And when you entered CD yourself, what peer group did you start in or did you enter?
Well, you start out at CEDU in discovery.
Okay.
Some of the other programs like Rocky Mountain Academy in Idaho would name the peer groups a little differently, but the actual CEDU High School at Running Springs started with discovery, which was about your first 6 months. Each peer group stage lasted approximately 6 months before you advanced to the next or were held back to another peer group and your time extended. The first one was Discovery. After that was Quest, then Challenge, New Horizons, and Summit. Those five stages were pretty much determined your full experience there.
Right, okay. And in your peer group, when you started in Discovery, are you with people the same age as yourself?
Oh, no. Age and grade meant nothing at CEDU High School.
Right.
You were put into a peer group with people of all ages, determined by when they arrived at the school.
Okay.
So a 2.5 year program, you'd be in a peer group. While I was 16, going on 17, when I got there, there were kids who were 14 or 15 in my peer group. I had to attend classes with them when I eventually was allowed. We were allowed to go into academics. We did every exercise there was together. You went through profits together. There were all sorts of different things that happened within that peer group that evolved as you advanced.
Right.
But there was no grades in any respect. And the academics were, let's just say, if you left California after CEDU, the entire 2.5 years that you were there was nothing. You had to repeat them.
Wow. Oh, my goodness. Okay, so really,
when I left CEDU after being there for 1 year, one single credit transferred to my new school.
Oh my goodness.
And I ended up having to do an extra year of high school because of it.
Okay, so we've covered peer groups here. You've mentioned a few times, you've spoken about raps, profits, and smushing. Just to touch upon for the listeners what those things include.
Well, smushing, as I understood it, was fairly unique to CEDU, but raps and profits are also known by the synonym name, the game and the trip. Raps were the synonym game facilitated by a couple of staff with students.
Okay.
They went on for about 4 to 5 hours every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday afternoon without fail. And the profits were the CEDU version of the trip, the 24-hour workshops that at Synanon involved a lot of LSD, sleep deprivation, food denial, stress positions, and all sorts of nasty, nasty things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They transferred over into profits, and instead of being based on acid and LSD culture, they became based on the book, The Prophet, by Khalil Gibran.
Okay.
Early CEDU program designers, of which I believe Mel Wasserman, his CDU friends, and then one of the original CDU program directors was also a longtime Synanon member.
Right.
Medium Anonymous, I believe, did the research on that one. But they had to differentiate themselves from Synanon because Synanon was garnering itself a bad name. Mm-hmm. So Synanon processes and changed them enough that they couldn't be tied back easily.
Right. Okay. Hence the name change from
right.
Yeah.
And the addition of Khalil Gibran's philosophies, like they would take a chapter on the truth and make that the truth prophet. The truth shall set you free.
Right.
And then the next prophet was the children's prophet. And another chapter of the prophet from Khalil Gibran would deal with nurturing your inner child and things of that nature. And they would base that trip or prophet around that one.
Okay.
And then move on. Instead of using the basic Synanon tenets and explanations for the things we did in the prophets, they shifted it to being based on Khalil Gibran's book instead of based upon Synanon methods, even okay. though the way they did it was 100% Synanon.
Okay, okay. And when you say they, I guess you're referring to staff members?
Correct, correct. CDU as an institution, but yes, the staff.
Okay, and what were the staff like there? What were they? What sort of what were their backgrounds, and you know, how did they come to be in these positions?
Well, the directors of the program were all OG Synanon. Mel Wasserman, his original program director, and his good friend when I was there, who ran the program from the background with a non-official title, Bill Lane,
okay.
The proprietor of Bill Lane and Associates. These are all OG Synanon members that have come through and started the program, designed the program, and down the line supervise and run the program.
Okay.
As far as the day-to-day staff, you had basically two different kinds. You had graduates of the CDU program that came back to work there, as well as local staff that was hired locally, screened, and then put through the program.
What were the backgrounds and credentials for the staff members?
None.
Okay, okay.
I do believe some had very small credentials and certifications, but there were no psychologists. There were no letters after the names. The grads like Russ Decker, one of the ones that I knew very well, who went through the RMA program and then came back to work at CDU in Running Springs. You had others like Rudy Bentz, who was a drama teacher locally before he and his wife were hired by CDU. Interviews have been done with staff like Dennis Dockstetter in the Liam Sheff documentary, and with Randy Rudolph, I believe, who Medium Anonymous interviewed, was also a local who just saw the advertisement and applied. One of the first things that they asked the prospective employees is what their comfort levels were with certain different aspects of the CDU program. If they expressed interest enough and were sold on it, they were hired and then put through the program in their first couple of years. They would go through the okay. profits with the residents.
Oh, okay. So staff participated in wraps and profits the same as CDU?
Yes, they
would
did.
You say, sorry, would you say students or residents?
I would say residents every time. There is a bit of a, you stop it. There is a bit of an argument about that, but it is the TTI industry, CDU itself, and those who have graduated the program and speak well of it afterwards would call themselves students.
Okay.
Lawyers who have dealt and sued the school through the years, as well as psychologists who have dealt with survivors and the survivors themselves who who aren't so keen on the program would all call themselves residents.
Right, okay.
So I think that's one of the big discrepancies between the two camps surrounding the institution. Right. They want us to be called students. We know that there was no academics in the first place, so why would we call ourselves that? We were residents or even patients.
Oh, right. So that definitely makes sense. But what doesn't make sense is that staff members would participate in these almost truth-telling sessions with children, essentially.
And some of their disclosures were absolutely horrific.
Can you give us some examples?
Now, there's one specifically that comes to mind, a staff member who was a former CEDU student who it was widely known and would talk frequently about lighting a homeless person on fire before he was sent to the CEDU program himself, and then later became a staff. Well, there were ones about sexual disclosures that were incredibly graphic coming from staff to students, to minors. There were, let's just say that we're talking about adults with an entire lifetime of disclosure and mistakes that were coming up with things that kids wouldn't even know that existed to do. So the disclosures were shocking, but in a way, the staff tried to use them as a way to identify with the students. When you would say, you're just trying to mess with me, or you're being an ass, or we don't, you know, your methods are out of line, they would justify, well, I was just like you, I had the same issues, I did this, and this. So why won't you take it from me? Because now I'm all better, and I'm all grown and such. So in a way, they used it as a way to try and identify with us when, in actuality, it just shocked and awed us to the point where I'm not about to go and try and take a swing at a guy who lit a homeless man on fire while he's screaming at me, because I know he's capable of extreme violence and has shown it.
And these are the types of adults that were allowed to work with vulnerable children.
Absolutely. You would have another staff member who would go into a rap and make extreme sexual disclosures to try and relate to a student who they were trying to drag sexual disclosures out of.
Right.
And then there are stories about that very same staff member when the student breaks down severely, literally spooning with that student of the opposite sex for an hour at a time to try and soothe them.
Right. And that would happen in the smushing sessions?
In the raps or in the smushing. Okay. I mean, you wouldn't sit there with the one I'm referencing. There's a testimonial you can find online regarding it of a female student who had a sexual disclosure dragged out of her in a rap by the staff member using his own sexual disclosures and then spooning her, literally calling the rap off an hour early so he could lay with her and cuddle with her on the floor to try and ease her. You know, things like this were not uncommon.
And during these rap sessions or truth-telling sessions, as I've read it be described on the internet as well, were you as residents permitted to attack the staff members who were also given disclosures?
It was permissible by the rules, but you wouldn't do it.
Right, okay.
Because these staff determined you. If you tried to call out a staff for something, A, they would go, hey, you know what? I'm staff. I don't have to abide by the same agreements as you do.
Okay.
And you would run the risk of angering them to the point where you would face repercussions on a personal level from that staff member later on. So when somebody holds your life in their hands, and the difference between all day work assignments and actually going to classes and living a normal day to day, you didn't really want to attack them. So okay. It was more of they guided and they threw their disclosures out and then said, hey, we're doing our work too. But nobody really confronted the staff on things, okay. Even though it was so-called permissible.
And during RAPS, if a staff member was trying to get a resident to disclose something that they simply didn't have to disclose, they're trying to entrap or enforce a resident almost to admit to something that they didn't do. Do you think that residents often took inspiration from the disclosures that staff were giving them? Just to have the spotlight off of them?
And each other's. One of the main factors, if you talk to any survivor, including myself, when you were expected to quote unquote do your work in a RAP, if there wasn't a dirt list that you had, you invented it. If you didn't pop off, but you knew that the staff member wanted to focus on you for some reason, you would just make it up. Oh yeah, I sang this song in the dorm, or I did this minor infraction just to try and I'll take dishes and be done with it.
Okay.
The more severe disclosures from the past, I mean, there were two different types. There were dirt lists of things that you did while you were at the school that you had to cop out to in RAPS and face mm-hmm. your music. Mm-hmm. And then there were the issues that oftentimes kids would invent things to try and get the heat off of them, which was never smart because it would come back again and again and again. Right. And you'd end up dealing with things that weren't actually true. One of the things is Synanon. There are statements from Synanon members that one of Chuck Dieterich's favorite methods in the game was lies and half-truths. That still advanced into CEDU because the pressure was there to disclose something that you could run your feelings on and do your work in the RAP. And if you didn't have it, you would face hostility and consequences for not going with the program. Okay. So you would invent something minor if you could, but if not, then whatever they were trying to get you to confess to, whether true or not, you would just out with it, scream at the floor, take your attacks from the RAP, and then try to move on.
Okay, and what if you didn't scream or cry? At what point did the staff member move on from you to another person?
You weren't doing your work.
Okay.
They would give you a few chances to really dig into it and get into it. And if you didn't respond to the attack therapy with some primal scream therapy of your own, then they would just assume that you weren't in touch with your feelings. You were lost in your thoughts, as they would say. And that you weren't willing to do your work, and you'd start with dishes and your consequences would get more and more severe until you have the desired primal scream therapy reaction to their attack methods in a future round.
Right. Okay. From your experience, were some staff worse than others?
Absolutely. I'll throw a few names out there and I got to throw this with the caveat that my experience at CEDU was a lot worse than most.
Okay.
I was a constant resistor. I was constantly on one varying degree of punishment or another. Okay. And certain staff made it their special project to mess with me. I have been referenced by staff in numerous interviews as one of the worst cases of consequences and abuse that was given to a student.
Right.
Medium Anonymous, in his interview with Ranulf Reynolds specifically talked about me without remembering my name. You've seen the picture of the giant stump that I was forced to dig out over a 2-month period.
He said
this poor kid was on it for a month. No, Randy, it was two.
And it was huge. It was a big tree stump as well.
So for me, it was a little different. There were some staff like Dennis Dockstetter and Randolph Reynolds that were a little easier to talk to, ones that were from the local community and then got hired on and went through the program. They seemed to be a bit more sympathetic. Right. There were exceptions to that rule, such as Rudy and his wife, Jill Bentz. who were also local staff hired on, went through the program, but turned out to be pretty monstrous. Then you have others like Russ Decker, who was my personal nemesis. He, I'd love to get in front of that guy someday, you know, have a discussion as to why he was so horrible. The students who went through the program and came to work there were typically much more aggressive,
right,
and prone to overarching responses to power struggle.
Right. And do you think that that is because they are almost...
They're insulted by the fact that you won't get with the program that right. they love okay. so much.
They are products of CD.
They were believers.
Okay,
they
okay.
They believed in the method wholeheartedly as it had worked for them. And if you couldn't get with it, it was almost a personal insult to them.
Right. And was there ever physical abuse as well as verbal abuse?
Absolutely. They were very careful. There are stories and testimonies out there about different staff. Myself personally, it was always minor. It was a staff member coming behind you and putting a grip on your pressure points on your neck.
Wow, okay.
It was enhanced stress positions. Very much like the military in many ways.
Okay.
There were staff that, one in particular that I remember from Ascent, which we'll, I'm sure, touch on later, that ran physical training and had a giant staff. Every time he made a student puke during the physical training, he would carve a new notch in the staff.
Oh my goodness.
There was no room for more notches on his 6-foot staff. So it was almost a pet project of different staff to abuse the kids to a point where they suffered greatly, but they wouldn't just punch you in the face.
Okay.
They would do something that was almost roundabout passive aggressive abuse. When it came down to sexual abuse, there was a bit more to it and there were more stories. Myself, I never personally experienced that, but a lot of the females that have testimony about this school speak to the predatory sexual nature of many of the male staff.
Well, even just spooning a female resident, you know, after she's disclosed something is in itself extremely inappropriate and questionable.
Absolutely.
When you talk about... staff members not having any credentials and the possibility of sexual abuse or sexual assault, I did touch upon Dr. Forgy in my previous episode, and James Lee Cromwell as well. Would you like to tell the listeners who they were and sort of a little bit of their connection with CDU?
Well, Dr. Burnell Forgy was the resident psychiatrist, for CDU School. He lived locally in Running Springs. He had a practice up there. He was contracted by the CDU School through the 90s to be the in-house psychiatrist.
Okay.
He had a personal assistant who he got a job as a night watch and a student driver on campus named James Lee Crummell.
Okay.
James Lee Crummell and Burnell Forgy were eventually arrested in 1998 for basically gang raping a minor.
A minor young boy?
Yes. How do I put this? James Lee Crummell was a patient of Dr. Forgy. I'm sure, this is my hypothesis, Dr. Forgy, as a pedophile himself, retained a friendship with James Lee Crummell to the point of moving him into his house for years.
Wow, okay.
Crummell lived with Dr. Forgy and was his personal assistant. James Lee Crummell had been investigated and prosecuted, unfortunately gotten off the charge on a couple of murders prior. Of young boys.
Okay.
He was suspected and a whole bunch of others. He had evaded the law, gotten together with Dr. Forgy, And then Dr. Forgy had gotten James Lee Crummell a job on the CEDU campus. Okay. The CEDU campus, due to its closed culture, was a prime feeding ground for predators of all types. There were two student disappearances never to be seen again while James Lee Crummell and Dr. Bernal Forgy were working on the CEDU campus. In 1993, John Inman, who was, I believe, 17 years old, suffered from severe seizures to the point where they had a stent put into his head, disappeared from campus without his seizure medicine one day, never to be seen again.
Okay.
Later the next year, in 1994, when I was there, a middle schooler named Blake Pursley disappeared one night, never to be seen again. Now, they may have split, which was the official story, out of the school, but they never called anyone, they never had any money, they didn't have the proper clothing, they were minors with medical issues out and about in the community. The hypothesis is, even though he never confessed to it while he was on death row before killing himself, James Lee Crummell was responsible for their disappearances.
Right. Okay. And it's my understanding that whilst he was working within CEDU, there was actually a warrant out for his arrest, so he was operating under a false name?
This is possible. I'm not certain of it. My interactions with him were blessedly minimal.
Okay. Okay.
So,
and when you say split, that means somebody who has run away?
Split was a term that actually carried over from Synanon. Chuck and the hierarchy used to call people who left Synanon splitties.
Okay.
That carried over to CEDU. If you left campus, you were said to have split. One of the things they love to say is that there are no bars or doors on the windows. You can come and go as you please. But the minute you set foot off of campus, A, you were either going down the backside of the mountain, which was about 4 miles of completely impassable terrain.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody ever really tried that. And if they did, it worked out horribly.
Okay.
Or you had to walk about 4 or 5 miles down a road to just to get to Running Springs in the local payphone, where they usually found you. Or you had to hitchhike your way all the way down the mountain to San Bernardino.
Wow. Okay. So this, the backside of this mountain, is it plausible that perhaps this is where children were taken by Crummell?
Where they were taken, how they were taken, any details of that, he kept with him to his death. The fact is that only a very select few splitties, and Medium Anonymous did the research when he contacted the San Bernardino County Sheriff's Department. There were massive numbers of kids that split from the CEDU campus every month. Every month there were dozens of calls to the Sheriff's Department.
Okay.
Now, maybe 1 to 2% of people who split even attempted going down the backside. Just looking at it, it was the most imposing thing you could ever look at. Any story of anybody who's ever tried is a horror story where they ended up right back at CEDU on their own accord before making it all the way down.
Okay.
So 9 out of 10 or more took what was called School Road into Running Springs to try and get to the payphone there. This was in a time before cell phones, 1993, 94. So getting to that payphone in Running Springs was pretty much every kid's mission, hoping that somebody would come get them or give them a place to go. 9.9 times out of 10, it didn't work out. We touched earlier on the escort service.
Yep.
That was run by Bill Lane, the ex-Synanon neophyte. He originally started an in-house escort service, as we called it. And as Synanon in the 70s and early 80s started falling way out of fashion and getting into legal issues, my hypothesis is that Bill Lane was kind of forced out of any official association with the school, okay, based upon his close ties to Chuck and Sinina.
Right.
So instead, he formed Bill Lane and Associates and handled the transport of students. To this day, the business, I believe Bill Lane and Associates, he died in 2018. They went bankrupt this last year. But it's an industry now known as, what do they call it? Therapeutic transportation, that was literally started by CDU, okay, and Bill Lane. He was the first in the therapeutic transportation business. And that's where your parents basically sign you over and they come to your house, grab you, take you to a program, or take you from one program to another. The movie Boot Camp from 2009 with Mila Kunis really goes into that. The opening scene of that movie is times two, actually. Both her, one of the, twice they introduce you to these escorts.
Okay. So there's so many things that you've mentioned here that I just want to quickly go back on and discuss, please, a little bit further. So when you watch films like Boot Camp, or when you listen to certain pieces of music from CDU that were played repeatedly, do these trigger you in any way?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I can't get into an elevator these days without shaking my head. You know, music in particular, they had certain approved songs that the staff would call snot suckers.
Okay.
Specifically designed to create an emotional situation. They were put on repeat, played during smush times, played during profits, during different sessions where you were expected to get in touch with your feelings.
Okay.
These snot suckers were things like John Denver, some Crosby, Stills, and Nash tunes.
Okay.
Basically exactly the ones you would think of that bring a tear to most people's eyes normally.
Right.
When I hear them now, instead of enjoying them, it just brings me right back. I shake my head. It's one of the reasons I listen to rap and heavy metal now.
Okay. And
the future is a hefty responsibility, and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
So the music was used to bring on further emotional feelings and openness,
yes,
to feeling all sorts of things during raps and smushing
so,
and such.
So while you're in a profit, as the staff is screaming at you that your parents don't love you, that's why you're here, that you're a horrible person to your parents, how can you imagine how much they must hate you after all the things that you've done to them? Cats in the Freaking Cradle is playing on repeat.
Oh my, that's...
So it was used to reinforce the emotional reactions and the primal scream therapy that they were attempting to drag out of you. As you're screaming at the floor, doing your work about how you're such a horrible person to your parents, how it's amazing that anybody could possibly love you, this and that. This music is just going on and on about, you know, Cat Stevens over and over, Cats in the Cradle, just playing it all the while. Everyone around you is attacking you, telling you what a horrible person you are to your parents and why they don't love you.
Okay.
It was very much. So music was a tool to them, and any music that wasn't useful as a tool was banned entirely.
Okay. And just going back to talking about Dr. Forgy. CDU employ a psychiatrist. They have him on campus. He has Cromwell with him as his assistant. What was Forgy's purpose on the campus?
Well, Dr. Forgy, in my judgment and estimation, he was a compliant psychiatrist. The more out of agreement you were and the more you rebelled against the program, the more likely you were to be sent to see Dr. Forgy.
Oh, right.
I had never taken psychotropic medications in my childhood. About a month or so into CDU, when it was plainly obvious that I was going to fight every bit of it,
okay,
they sent me to see Dr. Forgy, and Prozac was introduced to my life.
Right. Okay.
Now, this is a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, which is actually proven to increase suicidal ideations in adolescents, that was prescribed to me as an adolescent in a place that really made you want to kill yourself.
By an actual licensed psychiatrist.
By a pedophile psychiatrist.
And was it common at the time for residents to be given medication by Dr. Forgy?
Absolutely. He was there to, if you weren't on medication when you got there and you were struggling, you would see him and be put on medication. If you were on medication when you got there, you had to see Dr. Forgy periodically to evaluate your medication. And oftentimes he would change your prescriptions around to make you more compliant. There were other folks with medical issues like diabetics and seizures, as I said, John Inman had. They were also treated by Dr. Forgy for peripheral things as well. If you took medications, it was Dr. Forgy who was responsible for the dosage and the types that you took.
Right, okay.
There was a medication line that formed twice a day in the main hall. And if you were a patient of Dr. Forgy's, you were in it. CDU, you mentioned in the last episode on the background of CDU, it was in 1993-94 when Rocky Mountain Academy in Idaho started accepting students with mental disorders and diagnoses.
Yep.
CDU had been doing it for quite some time in Running Springs because they had Dr. Forgy. That was a model that they brought to the Idaho programs in the mid-90s when they contracted a psychiatrist out there, a guy named, I believe it was Dr. David or Doug Ulrich.
Ulrich, yes, yep. Okay, so we're starting to get an idea here of CDU being a sort of a perfect environment for all types of predators, whether it's paedophiles or those looking for positions of power. It's just like a closed circuit.
When James Lee Crummell abducted two children, as is widely believed right now, the official story was that they ran away. The case was given to the San Bernardino County Sheriff's Department and to the to Bill Lane and Associates, where he had his investigators try to track them down.
Yeah.
But the story was automatically put out that they split. It had nothing to do with the school. And therefore, there were no questions asked. The culture of everything was designed so that predators could successfully operate within the walls of the school.
Right. Okay.
They didn't even have to cover their own tracks because the school would cover their tracks for them.
Were there any other suspicious deaths or disappearances?
A lot of suicides went on. I know that when I first got to CDU, rumor spread and word came through about a suicide at RMA, Rocky Mountain Academy in Idaho. That turned out to be a student named, or a resident named John Avila, who hung himself. That was a true suicide. While I was there, I cannot for the life of me remember her name, but late 93, there was a girl who slit her wrists in the girls' dorms attached to the main building. Whether or not she survived, we never knew.
Wow.
So if there was somebody who attempted suicide, we didn't know if they succeeded or not. They just disappeared. And we were told that A, they were pulled, B, they were sent to another school, or C, that they split. So
that's so tragic. That's so sad. So
whether or not people, I mean, there were attempts all the time, but they were covered up. to the other students. So no matter what happened, unless you actually walked in on it, you were given some story that explained it away.
It sounds so much like Synanon in terms of the actual place policing itself. There seems to be, you know, no laws that CDU was working within or anybody carrying out any type of inspection or any background checks on staff.
Well, if you look at Medium Anonymous's reports, what has happened, he did a lot of deep digging on the legal issues that CDU faced. Not so much the lawsuits that eventually shut it down in the 2000s, but more the constant complaints that were brought to CDU by Children and Family Services in San Bernardino. Mm-hmm. They happened over and over and over again, but CDU had this way where even the authorities, when a report was made, would leave it to CDU to self-police itself.
Right, okay.
If they got a report that a student was being sleep-deprived, say, in a workshop, they would come in, they would evaluate it, and they would get a whole story from the staff. Oh, that's not true. This didn't happen. And then they would say, well, you know what? You guys need to make a policy where you lay it out that it's not okay for that to happen.
Okay.
And then CDU would be like, okay, we'll rewrite the policy, make sure everybody knows you can't give anybody sleep deprivation. And if it even appears that they have it, you've got to force them to sleep. And the Children Family Services would be like, okay, sounds good to us. And then CDU would just throw it away and go back to operating the way they were.
Is exactly what happens when you arrive at CDU and there's a list of policies and procedures that CDU promised they will work within that you sign your name at the bottom of, and it's almost like it comes across in a filing cabinet and it's
never seen again.
It's like a little inside joke almost between staff that they're getting you to sign a document that is almost the opposite of everything that they are going to put the students or residents through. You know, once the raps start and everything. Okay, so you've briefly mentioned Ascent and Idaho with their Rocky Mountain Academy. What are other programs that CDU were running, and how are they similar or different to your experience?
The thing about the other CDU programs is that the actual CDU High School in Running Springs was the only real constant throughout the entire life of CDU.
Okay.
There were multiple programs in Idaho that they expanded to. They were scattered in the panhandle of northern Idaho between Sandpoint and Bonner's Ferry to the north.
Okay.
There were schools such as Rocky Mountain Academy, which I believe was the first. That was a CDU clone up in that area.
Okay.
That one is the one that you can say was pretty much a carbon copy of CDU through the years.
Mm-hmm.
They also opened a school called Boulder Creek Academy, or BCA for short.
Okay.
And another one called Northwest Academy, or NWA for short.
Okay.
They had the Wilderness Program, their Wilderness Boot Camp, very much like the movie Boot Camp,
right,
that Mila Kunis referenced earlier. That was called Ascent, and that was up with Northwest Academy on Ruby Ridge, about a mile or so from the Weaver household.
Okay.
Throughout the years, they evolved. Northwest Academy, when it was first built, I believe in late 93, was supposed to be a last stop. It was sort of like an extended Ascent program. Whereas Boulder Creek Academy was more of a CDU light. As time went on, there was a riot at Northwest Academy that resulted in lawsuits.
Yep.
The next thing you know, Northwest Academy became more of a transitional living, where they sent the students that were approaching 18, and they lightened up the program tremendously, and they kind of evolved and shifted as time went on.
Okay.
I do believe there were one or two other Idaho programs, one maybe an early transition program, but I'm not certain of that. Going back to the power struggles, Ascent, the Wilderness Boot Camp, was used as a consequence.
Okay.
if you were put on a full-time at CEDU or at RMA or any of the other CEDU schools and you were at the peak of consequence and it still wasn't working, say they put you on a stump and it took you 2 months to get off that stump and you were still flipping the bird to the staff every time they came around, next thing you know, Bill Lane and his goons would show up.
Right.
You would be escorted to Ascent for their wilderness boot camp program. And then from there, it was used as a consequence. It was escalating, escalating consequence or severity of restriction. They always won the power struggles. If at Ascent, you still couldn't get with the program, the end all was up in Northern Idaho. That came about when they hired Dr. Ulrich as the Northern Idaho program psychiatrist. He was also the clinical director of Northern Idaho Behavioral Health.
Right, which okay.
In 93 was a psych ward for adolescents where you would stay temporarily. It was a great thing for parents too, because when you left Ascent or Aceto school and you ended up at Northern Idaho Behavioral Health, you had stopped paying CEDU the exorbitant tuitions, and all of a sudden your kid's insurance would be paying for it. So it was kind of a break for parents too. They didn't mind. Go ahead, send the kid there.
Wow.
Over time, Northern Idaho Behavioral Health turned into a more long-term program.
Okay.
The ultimate threat, like if you don't get an agreement, we'll send you to Ascent. You get sent to Ascent. If you still can't get an agreement, you'll go to NIBH. And NIBH was originally temporary, but then they actually formed a school out of it, basically a psych ward school, where you would be sent and you would stay as long as you needed to. Some testimonial about kids who just wouldn't get with the program. They spent a year or more at NIBH.
And right.
So there were other schools that were used as a threat as well, such as Provo Canyon School in Utah.
Yes, which I've read about that one.
Which is more of a cross of a lockup and a TTI.
Yeah.
They always had further consequence. If you wanted the power struggle with CEDU, you were going to lose every time. And they had a new place that was an even fresher level of hell. It was like dealing with Dante. Do you want the first or the seventh level of hell?
You could arrive at CEDU never having any prescribed medication in your life and end up being sent to a place like Northern Idaho Behavioral Health.
Yes.
That's absolutely terrifying.
How much resistance you had.
I watched a documentary called The Pharmacist the other day on Netflix, and they were talking all about the pill mills and how actually, people were being sent to have these prescriptions of OxyContin filled in, and it was seen as compassionate if you were a doctor that would prescribe this pain medication to somebody, even though actually it was not beneficial at all. And it almost feels like children being put on these medications, sent to these behavioral health units, educational consultants sending children to CEDU, it almost feels similar in the way that children are being extorted so that these industries can benefit off of the backs of the abuse of children. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. When CEDU first started, it was completely modeled after Synanon. The early CEDU out of Mel Wasserman's living room and when Running Springs first started was all not-for-profit. When Bill Lane came to officially work for CEDU in 74 during the transition from phase two to phase three of Synanon, that was the religious inspiration that Chuck Dietrich had. He actually came on while it was still a not-for-profit and ran the fundraising and the resource sourcing that the nonprofit, like, they completely individuated and distanced from Synanon. Bill Lane started Bill Lane and Associates and stopped officially working for CEDU because of his Synanon background. And things kind of evolved from there into a for-profit model that demanded that closed secrecy, because It threatened profits and investors.
Yep, definitely, absolutely.
And eventually sold to the Brown schools. I think, was it in 98-ish? It was, what, 60, 70 million? I'd have to go look at the number again.
Yeah, and they said
it was a valuable business.
It wasn't bankruptcy due to the lawsuits. It was some other reason. Can't think of what that could possibly be. Sure.
This is where I'm going to leave this half of the interview. As I mentioned before, anyone who would like to listen to part two, it is available now. If you have been affected by any of the themes within this episode, I will include links to support troubled teen industry survivors. Likewise, I will include links to all the memoirs and material mentioned in this episode. If you'd like to get in touch, you can do so by emailing me at cultvaultpodcast@gmail.com or find me on Twitter and Instagram at cultvaultpod. I am your speaker, Casey, and this has been the Cult Vault.